This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 14, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, podcaster, blogger, and host of The Bridge with Kira, Kira Young, as well as a trialogue with podcaster, author, and host of C-Realm Podcast, KMO. Rejoining me this week is my usual co-host and brother, Tom McGuire. On this episode, we delve into questions of social ecology and existentialism in the Western industrialized world. Having experienced themselves firsthand the trappings and hard diminishing returns of misleading mainstream narratives, they each seek to educate others about potential reality tunnels that operate outside the dominant mythologies of our day. While on one hand, they manage to keep their feet firmly tethered to the physical dimension, they also acknowledge the value and utility of higher aspirations of the mind. Thanks again to my guests this week, and thank you for listening. So joining us today on Pentimental is Kira Young. Kira is the host of The Bridge with Kira, and also her new show just premiered yesterday called The Moon Lodge, and this is on the People's Internet Radio Network. So Kira, thanks for being on.
Thanks for inviting me.
I just gave a really brief sketch of you, but there's so much more. So why don't you introduce yourself and give us a sense of who you are and what you're all about?
Okay, well, I do radio, but I'm just a regular person. I got into blogging and doing radio really as part of my search to heal myself, and I ran across Thomas Sheridan's work. I had read everything I could find on psychopaths because I was being targeted by one in my work environment, and his books were the most helpful I've found in his videos, and I really wanted to be part of the conversation. The biggest thing that I found that was helpful was that I couldn't find anything on female psychopaths. And I couldn't find anything that was more from the point of view of someone dealing with them rather than someone just trying to understand and treat them. And also, all of the stuff out there is about criminal psychopaths, so you don't get a sense of how they work and how they're legitimized in the larger culture. And I got that sense, and it really was so inspiring. I started a blog called Psychopaths in Charge. That's kyoung4 at wordpress.com. And it just kind of exploded from there. And then I called into Thomas Sheridan's show, and he interviewed me about female psychopaths in the workplace. And then his people that like his show said, she needs her show. So I said, hey, I'll give it a try. And so I've been doing that about a year now. And I'm finding that I'm getting intellectual stimulation that I didn't really realize that I needed. But now that I'm getting it, I realized that I was missing it for a while, and I'm getting to use all the things that I went to school for. I'm a philosophy major, and then I went to grad school with Matthew Fox and studied mysticism for my master's degree. So I'm getting to use that because I really wasn't accepted into academia. I was outcast, and so I had no way to pay back my student loans or use what I had learned, but I'm getting it now. So.
So you're a philosophy major, and certainly you get that sense because on your blog, you discuss kind of the differences between religion and science, but also more importantly, kind of their fundamentalist similarities. So maybe you can speak on that a little bit if you have some general feelings on that.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I look at that intersection is because my mother is both a mystic and a scientist. So, you know, being raised by someone with both of those really got me interested in both, I guess. And so I naturally sort of see the interconnection, and yeah, so, and always wanted to connect it. I mean, I know it's in academia, it's something we're kind of just coming to, but that's actually why I got my master's with Matthew Fox, because that's what they looked at too. I studied mysticism, but I also, the other teachers that taught there were like Rupert Sheldrake and cosmologist Brian Swim. And so I've always just been a seeker and really wanted to look at the exciting parts about being alive now. Yeah. And I do philosophy on the web.
What do you see as the biggest failing between both of them? Because, like I said, you draw some correlations that I think are interesting and actually pertinent to a bigger conversation. So, I mean, what do you see as the problem with both, or how are they more alike than they care to admit?
You know, they both derail us. They both derail our spiritual journey in a way, because they've been co-opted by the psychopaths in charge. So religion's been a tool for the elite to keep us not only physically enslaved, but mentally enslaved. And so in that way, it stunts our spiritual growth. And then science as well doesn't really have what it needs to unlock the mysteries of being, of consciousness. And so I get excited when I see scientists trying to look at that. And I get excited when I see people in religion pointing out, like my teacher, Matthew Fox, you know, this is the failing of religion, is people, you know, their spiritual journeys are being squashed.
Well, the interesting thing with science nowadays is that science likes to present itself as a sort of monolithic entity, where in fact, there's actually all these schools of thought within it, like any form of mysticism, which science is, it grew out of alchemy and still is a form of mysticism, mm-hmm. whether they care to admit it or not, because when you come to any belief system, there's always this insurmountable leap of faith. You have to assume there's either something or nothing beyond a certain event horizon. So we get down to the bottom point of the Big Bang, and we don't know what's before or after or what comes way later. But they just assume it's all material and don't draw on the mystical side of human consciousness, because we've just declared human consciousness as irrelevant. It's chemical processes in your brain. It's nothing more. That's the dogma, even though there's a whole other school of psychology that is basically arguing the same thing, which is that transpersonal or holographic or dualistic argument or school of thought. So in both ways, like you said, they deprive people, and this goes for religion too. Religion pretends that there's a patriarchal God in the sky that's going to punish you. And even if you go to Eastern religion, it's better in that it recognizes universal consciousness and Christ consciousness in everybody in a more general way. But at the same time, you still have Buddhist monks slaughtering people somewhere in Asia right now. No religion doesn't have all this blood on its hands. So it's not spirituality, mm-hmm. and it's not the pursuit of like the truth in nature. That's the problem. It's how these things have been institutionalized, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do we find that on our own? What do you do?
Well, for myself, my spiritual practice is compassion and gratitude. And so I start every day with a thank you prayer. It orients me towards what's important. I live in the woods. I do try to be observant about the cycles of nature and the changes that are happening in our world. So it's working for me right now.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong anywhere along the line, but you're part Native American and you have some familiarity with that culture and that side of maybe seeing nature in a symbiotic or more synchronistic way. And maybe you can let us in on how that's kind of informed either your study generally or just your life's path.
Mm. Well, you know, starting as a young person, my desire to learn about my native heritage and that native side of my family, which is chalked on my mom's side. It's funny now looking at my journey and my path to finding out more about that, because it led me back to myself in that the realization that we really all have this indigenous part of ourselves, that those of us who are switched on and awake, you know, try to find that part of ourselves. So I guess in kind of being honest about my journey is that, you know, I grew up as a white person, but I always knew there was something different about us. And so I asked my mom one day, because I had had dreams about my mom's grandmother. And she informed me that all of my dreams were correct and, you know, that we were Choctaw. So that started me questioning, well, why don't we ever talk about that? Why is it something that just wasn't readily discussed? Why did I have to ask you about it? So I really, really started searching. And the day that my identity, there's really a day that I can point to and say where my identity changed from being a white person to being what I am now, which is not white and just who I am. I'm a mixed person. I went to a powwow in Oakland, California, which is where I happened to meet my husband. And I ran into a Choctaw lady and we were talking about her earrings and her artistry. And I said to her, you know, my great grandmother was Choctaw. And she just looked at me and very seriously and said, well, that makes you Choctaw too. And so that's the day that my identity really sort of shifted. And since then, I guess I've been invited in and been taught songs. My teacher, I had a Lakota teacher in graduate school who introduced me to my husband, who's Prairie Band Potawatomi in Northern Cheyenne. And then he taught me his songs and I learned how to sing powwow. And that really awakened another part of myself. And I've been married to my husband for 14 years. We have a 9-year-old son and we sing at powwows. And it's, I don't know how to describe it, but it's just where I am right now. In America, you can't really identify as a mixed person. Like there's no mixed sort of culture like there is in Canada and even down in Mexico. It's in America, the way that we are taught to think about Indians, you know, is that you either are or you aren't, or you are 2 degrees because of blood quantum law. So Indians are the only people that you ask, like, well, how much Indian are you? Are you a quarter? Are you half? Are you this? Are you that? So I like to look at stuff like that too. And I have one of my blog articles is called Indian Country Needs More Anarchy. And it's about how, you know, our thoughts about ourselves, you know, as Indians or ourselves, in my case, as white people, are really informed by these political policies of yesteryear. And so I try to blow that up. I try to deconstruct that in my own life and then for my son too.
Well, I mean, identity, especially in America, is so difficult because we deny our history largely. I mean, it is a country built on blood, like so many nation states, but ours is specifically more geared towards Native Americans and African Americans. And more recently, you could argue Mexican Americans to serve corporate interests, government interests for cheap labor. It's always been that way. And anything we think of as prosperity or someone's ingenuity or pulling themselves up from their bootstraps, it's always kind of been built upon that premise of exploitation. And so that's been denied to a lot of people here. And it's even been denied to people in other places, but they've, I don't know, embraced it in a different way. But historically speaking, I always see that as the barrier. And then you're taught that history in school. And I don't know what else to say about it, except that it's a wisdom that's been denied to people because we don't have wisdom in our culture. We just don't. And indigenous cultures, more than anything, they don't have whatever the sophisticated rationality of Stephen Hawking, but there's all this wisdom that makes perfect sense that even the most educated person on earth doesn't have. That I hear all these high priests of our culture saying all these ridiculous things, and then I can listen to Black Elk Speaks. I'm assuming you've read that, or maybe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
There's a man that's just so in tune with the human experience. I'd rather listen to him and follow him. And maybe you can speak on that, this intelligence versus wisdom thing and what we've lost.
Well, I tell you, one of the things that I learned by seeking this part of myself and being invited in is that Native concept of wealth is completely the opposite of the non-Native concept of wealth. And, you know, of course, it's changed over the years, but the traditional concept of wealth, and for many have kept this, is that the richest family in the tribe was the one that gave away the most, because it's a privilege to be able to give away and because our existence, we're here because we share, you know, we are because we share. And there's this constant focus on the fact that we all need each other. That sort of individualism is not as strong, I guess, in more traditional communities. But the other thing is that there's always this comfort level with seemingly opposing simultaneous realities. So there's always this comfort level with the opposites that exist. There's not this need for dualism or categorization of, and there's also not a need for constant talk. I mean, like me and my husband were quite happy just sitting around saying nothing to each other for long periods of time.
Well, and rightfully so, because without silence, you can't hear yourself. And that's what most people do, and especially American culture. It's just, let's fill our days with TV. Let's fill it with celebrity gossip. Let's fill it with pop music that's poisoning everything. It's constantly chasing the next thing instead of just standing still. we need that inner silence to discover anything about ourselves. And sure, we've all done it, but I think we fall victim to that urge to just, again, what's next? What's next? What's next? Because only in the silence can you let the horror of it all kind of set in and not scare you straight, because that doesn't work, but you have to embrace a certain dimension of horror in contemplating, I don't know, your sense of self and how you fit in.
The wholeness.
Yeah.
Thing that is. Yeah, sure. And I think we all have a mystical side to us, maybe some more than others. So we all have the capacity for mystical experiences. But I guess, you know, I'm kind of like my mother, so I had them a lot. And just so I try to share them because I realize that people don't have this sort of orientation that I've been actually gifted with, probably through trauma, oddly enough. But, you know, that's the other weird thing too. And you find it in myth, you know, the descent myths.
Well, that gets us into archetypes and what have you. And so, yeah, how do you see those intersection between archetypes and maybe like indigenous cosmology? And do you draw these connections or do you see similarities? Are they separate in your mind?
Yeah, I do. And actually, this is kind of interesting. It's more Greek mythology, but my mother has a farm and she calls it Demeter's Garden. And Demeter was the Greek goddess of the grain. And her daughter was Persephone. And I call, you know, oddly enough, we have 6 acres, just a little 6 acres, but I call it Persephone's patch. But the story of Demeter and Persephone was taken to the underworld. She was just a free maiden off in a field frolicking. And because her father agreed with Hades, the god of the underworld, to marry her off, he came and took her and raped her and took her down to the underworld. And so Demeter went to Zeus and said, you know, let Persephone go. And he refused. And so she stopped everything from growing. And the people started starving and they started begging the gods, you know, what have we done? Help us. We're dying. And so he agreed to allow Persephone back. And when she came back, Demeter asked her, did you eat anything while you were down there? And she said, well, yeah, he gave me pomegranate seed. And so that's her symbol too, is the pomegranate. But because she ate while she was in the underworld, she had to go back. And so that's the Greek story of how the seasons started. It was from Persephone's having to go back to the underworld for 6 months a year. But it's just sort of by chance that we've oriented ourselves to these particular goddesses. But it does tell a story. It does reflect our lives as well. So that's one. That's just one level of it, I guess, in my life.
It is funny that you bring up Persephone and the pomegranate, because I just finished this book called Enochian Magic. It's a selection from Aleister Crowley's work. And he talks, basically, I mean, he's recounting the same individuation or self-discovery process that descent into the underworld describes. And he was bringing up pomegranates quite a bit in a section of the book. And I thought to myself, that's interesting, but I don't know where that's coming from. And now, of course, synchronistically, you bring it up. I literally just finished that book a day or two ago.
And isn't it interesting that pomegranates are so rich in nutrition? Mm-hmm. It's like you still need, there's a lot there to feed you in the dark. Just a thought.
It reminds you that descending into the darkness doesn't necessarily have to be the most horrific thing ever, that there is still something, there's sustenance through the dark times. And I think that's what it's largely communicating. Because sometimes we either say, well, in the synchromystic community, whatever you want to call it, it's either pure joy or it's all hell. And it's like, well, it's neither. It's like a mix of both. And that's something we always have to remind ourselves of. It's like, you need balance. You need to both be in the world and be totally in outer space sometimes at the same time. And it's hard to learn to coexist that way. But that's always been the secret to human existence. If you really want to be satisfied, it's always that middle ground. And people are always drawn to these extremes. You're either a far right Republican or a far left liberal. It's like, really, there's nothing in between these labels. These scientific labels that we put on each other and put on ourselves and feel like we need to meet someone else's expectations beyond our own. So I guess anyone that starts to question things is always going to be in the middle ground and we'll always have our differences. But at some point, I can't help but just see all these similarities piling up. between cultures, between thinking processes at root level, and even these mythologies. So I can't disassociate Jung from indigenous wisdom, and I can't, you know, right. I see the feedback between them that it's just, it's the human story coming out in a different cultural context yeah. every time. Mm-hmm. So the more we change, the more we stay the same.
Yeah.
Perfect way of saying what's going
yeah.
on. And so like, even when we think we're divided people, it's like, well, there's a wholeness to everything. It's like, okay, well, in your case, you've been basically kept from this whole part of yourself for a long time, and then you're discovering it. But at the same time, mm-hmm. it's just, we can't integrate on a superficial level, but when we get really deep, there's always unity. And I think that's kind of what philosophy should teach you. And at the same time, yeah, so caring about other people while at the same time understanding you kind of are the center of the universe, but you're not. It's this hard mm-hmm. line to walk, for sure. And we just haven't learned to do that as a culture, I think. And that's kind of what all this is. It's evolution, because consciousness is part of it.
On the individual level and on the...
On the collective level. It's like everyone is... Yeah. We're all one and one is all. If you get into quantum physics at all, and of course that's the cliche, it's like, oh, quantum physics shows us we're all one. And yeah, okay... Like, you have interesting things to say on the New Age. So that gets me into that, because the New Age has co-opted quantum physics to a lot of degree. And so, I mean, what's your take on that? So we can criticize yeah. hardline religion, we yeah. can criticize hardline science, but what's wrong with, like, that New Age that purports to be the middle ground, but I don't see it as that.
Well, the New Age denies the darkness, right? Denies
exactly.
the lighting. You know, so that's where the problem is. I think, you know, it's probably an agenda that got thrown in there. I wouldn't doubt that at all, because there were some thinkers, there are thinkers who would probably be labeled New Age that really aren't. And then there's those that are not labeled New Age that are. So for me, that's why I break it down to who is it that's denying the dark or trivializing it, or, and so you can see it in religion too. Then you can see how the New Age is really just the same lie that religion tells you. It's just in a different package. So it's another way to derail the spiritual journey.
Is the issue then, because if we deny the dark, then we don't know how to put it into any context? Is that the danger, or do you see it as something different?
Yeah, I do. I see it as something different, because see, the everything works in cycles, but the cycles are a spiral. And you know, the way forward is the way back. And I'm not trying to sound like crazy here, but there's something important in recognizing cycles, but there's also something important, and we were talking about this last night in the Moon Lodge, is there's something important about recognizing where you are when you get back to that place again in your spiritual journey. And so in my interview with Matthew Fox, who founded the school where I got my master's degree, he talks about the four paths, which is one way of understanding our spiritual journey as, you know, the positive, the negative, the creative, and the transformative, and how this all, you know, works in a spiral. And if you deny the dark, you're basically cutting off your spiritual journey at the knees, like when you're just getting started, before you even get into your creative flow and your transformative flow. And this is a constant flow. And so that flow is stopped up at denying the negative. So does that make a little more sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe at root level there is a unity, but anything that gives, if we want experience, if we want to feel a sense of selfness, you need an opposite to measure yourself against, or nothing makes sense. It's just, I see the same thing around me. How can I ever draw any conclusions about anything? So unity is a powerful concept in that it reminds us that we rely on each other, and we all come from the same source. But at the same time, if that's all there is and we deny individualism and that kind of thing, then we start getting into groupthink and we become herd animals that are easily kind of yeah. towed around. And again, middle ground, it's like you got to be able to skirt both of these territories properly. And that's just not easy to do, because we're not educated to do that in any way. And so people have to kind of like reject everything they've accepted up to a certain point to liberate yourself in a sense. But that's a lot to ask of people.
We're not taught, we're punished really as critical thinkers from the very beginning.
And as far as anything goes, because I mean, you're taught that there's right answers, and the right answers are on the test. You fill in the right bubble and you advance. And if you don't, you get held back or whatever. And so we're taught in right and wrong. And there is no room to explore that. What's the intersection? What are the more complicated issues here? And they're like, well, good luck. You can figure that out on your own. But it's not, because right off the gate, you're inflicted with survival anxiety and false scarcity, which is a cultural thing, but it's never recognized and never communicated to you. So how would you even know that you're a part of that beforehand? So the education is, again, it's like it's keeping you in the dark while at the same time feeding you what the system needs you to internalize to keep the system going. It's a strange matrix-like situation. And so, of course, the matrix is the perfect analogy to reality in so many ways. And it's so obvious, but yeah.
Tell me more about this false scarcity idea.
Well, false scarcity, it's the concept that capitalism is based on the idea that there's not enough to go around, that there's not enough money to go around, that we're all competing for it. It's a false scarcity idea, but the whole idea of Eden is that there's enough for everybody. And actually, in small networks that add up to larger networks of like small farming and all that stuff, we could feed everybody easily. And even in our modern system, we have enough food to feed everybody. The question is, why doesn't it go to the right places? So that's artificial scarcity. We have silos of grain rotting away and right. Then pretending that there's not enough food to go around. There's too many people on the planet that, oh, we have to control population, this kinds of shit. Mm-hmm. No, they're practicing artificial scarcity and pretending the food supply is lower than it really is, that no one's told about the silos of grain rotting away. No one talks about how much charity gets skimmed off in the middle and nothing gets to people that really need it, that really it's just staying in the country that it originated from. And then you get to the money system. I mean, you could get really into that, which is like artificial scarcity incarnate, which is everything is born into, all money's born into existence with debt. So there's never enough to go around. So it's a game of monetary musical chairs. And everyone pretends that competition is our nature and that we have to kill each other to get what we need. But it's false scarcity. There's a historical concept called stratification, social stratification, and how resources are stratified or leveled or doled out in a society. And whoever controls whatever, the warehouse full of food is going to control everybody. And that's what Monsanto, that's why Monsanto's hoarding the seeds. That's why the banks hoard the money. It's just, right. So that's what I mean by artificial scarcity.
Yeah. So in order to maintain artificial scarcity, you have to be taught to live in lack, to live as though there's not enough when the earth is making enough for everyone all the time.
Right.
You know, so you have to be taught to deny reality, literally, what's right in front of your face in order to maintain that bureaucratic evilness that dreamed up by the psychopaths in charge, which is false scarcity.
Exactly. It would require a questioning of the entire system, which is what people don't want to do. It's so hard. It's such a big, it's such a mountain to climb. Oh, we have to reorder how we do things. And even we can't even do that on an individual level, let alone a collective level. Well, I like to think we can. It's just that's where the fear comes in. It's like if we can't confront that as people, individuals, what hope do we have as a collective? So when we get together as a collective of basically disoriented and traumatized and people in denial, then you create a denialist, repression-filled, dysfunctional society. It's not a reductionist approach. It's not the parts don't necessarily make the whole, but the whole doesn't necessarily make the parts. It's like they feed into each other and there's a feedback loop and we have to learn to understand that. So that's why I like still draw on science. I consider myself a mystic now, but science is so important to understanding how we affect each other in a mechanical way. You have to understand the mechanical nature of yourself. Even though it's not all of yourself, there are those like mechanical concepts of, okay, I affect you, you affect me. That's feedback. Okay. There's no real connection between us. What does that fundamentally mean? And these kinds of things. And also again, like how does a system work back on its parts? We always think of the engines made up of the gears and all this stuff. And we don't think of the engine running the parts themselves, but that's largely how human society works. So how are we guided by our institutions? We don't question them. It's the water we live in. We just take it for granted. That's what wisdom is. It's just like knowing how to question. We don't know how to question anything anymore, or so it seems.
Yeah, because I think, you know, maybe because of the largeness of what we have to dismantle to get to reality, I'm thinking that we kind of all have to be mystics to make sense of it, but we aren't all aware on that level. So,
well, what does it mean to be a mystic to you? What do you see? What do you feel? What do you hear when you feel like you're bringing back something that's worth telling other people? If that's even a relatable idea or concept, it's not easy, I know.
Well, we all have the capacity for experiencing that oneness or that connection. So my mystical experiences would be like, say, communicating with a wild animal. Know that you've had a communication with a wild animal, talking to them, things like that, where there's no one around. There's no separation of, you know, dangerous person, wild animal. So that connection. So we all have the possibility of recognizing ourselves in relation to, in connection to, as something part of. So I think that's really what being a mystic is about. And so because we're in this culture that's always separating us from that recognition of self in relation to, you know, that we all, you know, naturally our creative side as artists, we all sort of point to that. We're all pointing to our connections as artists because that's what's so important now, what we need to remind ourselves of.
So I'd argue a lot of what we're talking about here is sort of spiritual medicine or something akin to that. It's medicine for just your psychology. But at the same time, again, we're in the physical world. So there's a physical aspect to health too. And I know that's part of your schema and what you're focused on. So I guess, what is your approach to health nowadays, or how do you see it in a larger context or picture? And what's your form of activism when it comes to that side of your life?
Well, I spent a really long period of time being sick and not knowing what was making me sick. And so in that time, I got to experience really what's out there to help somebody who was in my situation. And when I finally discovered it, that it was wheat that was making me sick, that made me a cripple and that, you know, took my life away for a long time. I had to look at the bigger picture because I had to look back at how the system utterly and completely failed me. So my own form of activism is just in telling my story that if you have an autoimmune disease, if you have one of these new syndromes out there that they have drugs, you know, specifically designed to medicate, you have that because something you're consuming, something in your environment is making you sick. And the medical establishment cannot and will not help you because they're designed not to. They're designed to keep you sick and keep you fat and keep you stupid and keep you drugged. So my own role, I don't rely on the medical community for chronic issues because they suck at that. They're good with the, you know, acute issues.
Right. If I get into a car crash and I have a bunch of broken bones, I want that aspect of the medical establishment to be at my back, but I don't want them to pump me full of pills to address my psychological issues or something like that.
Yeah. Or the physical ones, you know, I mean, autoimmune disease. Yeah. It's absolutely massive. And what I'm looking at right now and what I'm writing about and researching and all that is all of those interconnections that keep the system the way it is now. We have basically a conspiracy between the FDA, the Department of Agriculture, the medical establishment, and the educational establishment to keep us living in the food pyramid and to keep grains at the base. Grains should not be at the base of our nutritional pyramid. We shouldn't even use grains like all year long. We should use them seasonally and sparsely throughout our diet, not as the base. And because grains are sitting around rotting, our grains are filled with pesticides, herbicides, molds, and tons of other toxins, and all of those things play into it. Roundup plays into it, and it's really epidemic. And it's invisible because it expresses itself in the human body in so many different ways. So you can call it diabetes, you can call it lupus, you can call it MS, you can call it fibromyalgia, you know, you can call it arthritis, you can call it Hashimoto's disease, you can call it all kinds of things, but it's the same thing. You're being poisoned by what you're eating.
I was just having a conversation with my brother the other day about the spirituality of food or something, and I was articulating that I've never been much of a foodie. I'm just very picky and adolescent and childish that way. And at the same time, then he said, well, there's a spiritual aspect to it. And I said, okay, what do you mean? He said, well, it depends on how much you accept your deeper self. And like, is there like a spark there that you would label spiritual or whatever? And then what is food doing for you? It's letting your your human suit perpetuate itself so you can learn and grow. Mm. You can keep growing that inner light or whatever. And so there is this spiritual aspect to it, just that it gives you that alone. And then when we look at how animals are raised and slaughtered and all these other aspects of even like monocultures and what that represents in an energetic or spiritual sense, it's like we're ingesting even spiritual poison because we're ingesting fear and those memories are stored in that flesh and that even in the plant material or whatever. I'm convinced of that.
Right.
You know, you mentioned Sheldrake very early.
Right.
That feeds totally into that premise. And so the inner and the outer, there's all this intersection. It's insane. Like we definitely create, I don't even know where the self and the external world begin sometimes based on these ideas. You know, it's really hard to separate them, but that's such a huge question. And I think goes beyond just the materialist. Do people have enough to eat? Well, yeah, I mean, that's important, but again, it's like, it's all these other questions too. And how long does our body sustain? And does that give you enough time to grow or do whatever your life's mission is or something like that? So it is really important, even to sustaining your material form is important. Social justice is important. Hello, you can't ignore these issues. Mm-hmm. And not saying we all have the power to change them, but it's like you should be integrating them in your art or your, I don't know. Art is a rebellion against culture. If you're just going to ignore culture in your art, what's the point of it? What are you doing? Mm-hmm. You're just producing nothing.
Well, one of the things I think that, you know, I try to look at what are the undercurrents of what we're being taught to think about ourselves. I just started looking at this really early. And I think one of the problems is that we're taught to sort of apologize for existing. And that really connects in with this false scarcity thing that we were talking about earlier. And so under this system, we have to apologize for existing because we require sustenance to live. And so the other thing that derails our spiritual journey when we start to recognize that all the other beings have feelings and like you were talking about with their feelings being stored in their flesh and things is it does take other beings dying for us to carry on. We don't have to go slaughtering, you know, left and right all, you know, throughout our lives, but we evolved and grew and developed by eating animal flesh and we need animal fats to think and for, you know, our bodily functions and things like that. So how do we take that reality and not ignore that those animals have feelings and things too? And I guess what I was taught is that you have to thank the spirit of that animal and try not to eat massive quantities of meat. You know, you really don't need that much of it, but you do need it. So I'm just throwing it out there. Don't apologize for existing. It's really important.
Right. And again, the whole issue of animal ethics and whatnot, I mean, it's obvious on one level, but then, you know, is it wrong to eat animals, period? And of course it's not. It's animals don't have the same level of consciousness as us for a reason. It's because this kind of symbiotic thing exists, and I couldn't tell you why. But at the same time, I guess if we're going to chalk it up to, if we're really going to speculate, maybe the greatest amount of memory and information is really stored up in physical form. So we always like to depreciate matter and the physical form, but there's like the spiritual aspect to it that is actually incredibly relevant and incredibly important to understanding. It's because if we just deny our material selves or the world we live in, even though I think it is kind of the Gnostic black iron prison in one sense, striving within it is the point to the escape. It's not just like escaping it and doing nothing. It's striving and mentally freeing yourself at the same time. So what is the golden rule of magic? It's like, don't expect anything back. Just do it for doing its sake. You know it's right, so do it. You know it's right. It's just like, what do you need? Like a fucking pat on the back or like a slap on the ass to like get you going all the time to know that it's the right thing to do? Just, I think when you come around to that idea that you're both the center of the universe and not the center of the universe, you need some balance in your life. And it can't just all be about you and it can't all just be about other people. And that makes you confront things about yourself too. So by going out into the world and measuring yourself that way, it like makes you reflect on yourself. And there's always this feedback. It's a back and forth. And so maybe that's why the human experience is so impossible to wrap our heads around. It is meant to be impossible, but it's meant to like push you and to do things.
Yeah. I just wish it was easier sometimes. There was less pain involved.
Obviously, but I mean, if we're going to have to intellectualize this and fit it into some kind of framework for moving forward, I mean, that seems to work for me, I guess. That's the only way I can rationalize it. Because you can't know what's on the other side until we're dead. Mm-hmm. And even when we're dead, it's like if your memories are taken away and you start all over again. I don't know the answers to these questions. No one does.
We are hardwired to avoid pain and seek pleasure. I mean, we are hardwired for that. So, you know, it's worth being conscious of that, I think, given that the psychopaths in charge will use that to steer you in certain directions. So recognizing that and overcoming that is important in, you know, the quest for freedom. Really looking at how you're hardwired, because they've been looking at us for a long time. So,
right. If you don't understand yourself, yeah, I mean, you're just right picking for those more insecure people amongst us need to control other people to get satisfaction or some sense of self-gratification. I mean, that's sociopathy and psychopathy. It's often tied to there's literally physically things maybe off about the human brain or something. But at the same time, there's always ways to address that. And second, we have plenty of people that seem like psychopaths that really aren't. They're just totally insecure, totally desperate people. Mm. And the only way to satisfy that desperation or that like thirst for gratification is to control someone else. And that's what murderers do. I mean, you always hear serial killers, like the control of another person gave me like fulfillment. Mm. We create those people in so many ways. And so many of them also are also just kind of imbalanced to begin with. But then we push them in a certain direction. And then we like to pretend they're the boogeyman. It's like all these horrible people in our society we have to protect ourselves against. But we've made them. We've created our own boogeyman. And that's maybe the most horrifying prospect for us to face as a people. And why we don't do it, because it's too scary.
Yeah, so that's how we can have the death penalty, right? Because murder is something the other does. But I tell you, in terms of, you know, the rare, real psychopaths out there, they're certainly not all killers, are they? Not at all. That's the biggest misunderstanding about them, is that there are all these extreme versions of them, which are, you know, axe murdering rapists. But no, yeah, that's the sad truth, is that, you know, some people who aren't are axe murdering rapists, and some people who are running countries and corporations.
Yeah, everyone satisfies that need in some way. And it always depends on context in so many ways. It's like, you know, if you're really, I don't know, if you're a George W. Bush or something, it's like you're going to be sheltered your entire life and let your insanity be allowed to grow, and you're basically made to be a politician to control people. Mm-hmm. Or you start from nowhere and you actually aspire to that and you make it, which is rare, but it happens. But then, you know, someone like Jeffrey Dahmer, who's like lower middle class, who is dysfunctional and going through situations where he can't deal with homosexuality and broken home life and problems at school. And yeah, I mean, he's having issues, but at the same time, again, we create these people. They have issues that we just don't know how to address them as a society, because we are dogmatic and we're bigoted and we're prejudiced. And this all goes back to what is this country built upon? The blood of indigenous and people and African people. Mm-hmm. And so we've been in denial forever. So we don't know how to address people with denial issues. We don't know how to address anything that's like a subculture or a sub-psychology. We just drug you and tell you you're sick or whatever. You're not normal. Normal is the new religion. That's my favorite Neil Kramer quote.
I like that one, because that's the other side of living so fearfully, is that, you know, you're not normal when there really is no normal. So, yeah, that's another derailment right there.
Yeah, it's like settling on a definition of normal. Let's just all accept each other for who we are. And if we're having problems, we back each other up. And that's fundamentally how humans have always gotten along. There doesn't have to be all these complex esoteric rules about governing. People are just wise. They're naturally wise when allowed to be, when not made part of mega systems and told what they are. We have a nature.
Yeah.
We don't need to be told. We're not bad, right?
Yeah, definitely. That is our true nature. And the psychopaths in charge don't want us to know that, but we do anyway.
Kira, we've had a really good conversation today. We're getting towards the end of our time together. So maybe you can just remind the audience of where to find your material, maybe what you're working on, your new show, all that stuff.
Okay. Well, you can find me on peoplesinternetradio.com. I have a radio show called The Bridge with Kira, which is you can find in the podcast storage page. And then I also have a new show called The Moon Lodge, which is just done on the new moon. And I do that with Carrie Lee. from Recipe for Anarchy, and she's got a new show coming up as well. And I also have a blog called Psychopaths in Charge, which is at kyoung4.wordpress.com.
All right. So yeah, I'll provide links for all that, and I encourage people to check you out. And thanks again for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.